Hiya, hiya, hiya. It's Alan here. Get your calls in early. We've got the great Bob Berman with us this morning, afternoon, and he is going to be telling you about all kinds of things. He is one of the most distinguished astronomers in the world and is much sought after, has articles in so many places. And tonight you're going to be somewhere, aren't you, Bob?
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for that kind introduction, Alan. I'll be at Great Barrington at 7 o'clock at the Triplex Theater doing a talk demonstration, a lot of fun stuff about light and color and how our eyes see it and the strange things that happen and even weird stuff.
Let me just say that I'm an intimate of the Triplex Theater, and I can tell you that there aren't that many seats in any of the theaters. Now, how do you get your tickets? How do you get into this thing? Do you know?
I think just at the door.
Yeah,
tonight.
So if I were you, folks, and you want to hear the great Bob Berman, I'd get down there to the Rotary Way in the Triplex Theater and get those tickets fast.
That's
a benefit for the airport. Is it not in Great Barrington?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, it's a terrific opportunity for everybody. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take your calls about astronomy, and there's nobody better to talk to about it than Bob Berman. I guess I want to start with the magic word, Venus.
Yes, it's been so brilliant in the West, creating all these UFO reports to police stations and observatories for the last few months. We've all seen it, that dazzling object in the West, but it's going bye-bye and with a vengeance, because it's going to cross the face of the sun on June 5th. That's coming up soon now.
Whoa. So what happens when that happens?
It's called a transit. And after this one's over, there won't be another till 2117. So if your gym membership doesn't get you to 105 years, if you're not going to be alive 105 and a half years from now, you'll never see another one. And you don't even need a telescope. It's visible with the naked eye as long as you have eye protection.
Yeah, there's always some idiot out there. So I think we have to remind everybody, you don't look at this with the naked eye.
That's right. Staring at the sun isn't a good idea. But the best is either to go to a place, and there'll be many places, astronomy clubs, Mohawk Mountain House is one, that will be holding the event and having the right filters for everybody who comes. So they'll be setting up. But if you just want to see it from your backyard, one quick way is to go to a welding supply store, which are never at the mall.
Yeah, yeah.
That's usually in the worst part of town with barking dogs.
Sure, barking dogs.
And you'll get number 12. You have to remember, 12. Filter number 12. That's the filter you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a common welding filter, so it's easy to get. And a few dollars. You don't even need the whole goggle unless you're going to be welding your car at the same time and repairing your car. Just the replacement filter is good enough, and then you can watch it. It'll start at 6:21 in the afternoon on June 5th. And then proceed until the sun sets.
Have you ever met anybody who damaged their eyes by looking at the sun directly?
Never.
Interesting.
And I've done some pretty stupid things in my youth with telescopes. I've gotten full blasts of the sun through a telescope, which is supposedly blind you immediately.
So what are we going to see in this Venus thing? In other words, if you're looking at it, you're looking at it properly, what will it look like?
It's going to look like a little tiny dot slowly crossing the face of the sun. And
no.
If you want it to be a bigger dot, what I'm going to do, and anybody who has a little bit of a confidence in themselves, take that welding filter and duct tape it to the end of a binocular. Not the part you look through, but the big lens at the far
end. Yeah.
In other words, you want to block the light before it even gets into the
binocular. We have those.
Right, exactly. And you want to duct tape it. But only if you feel like you could do it so that it's not going to fall off, that you're not going to pass it to your kid, and then it'll fall off and your kid will be blind for the rest of his life.
Oh,
so
boy.
You only want to do this if you're sure that your duct taping job is absolutely firm and secure. But if you think you can do it, that's the way to really see it best. Just plain ordinary binoculars with that number 12 filter over it.
That is so cool. So you might even think that some bug is crossing over the front of your binoculars because you're going to be looking at the sun, but there is going to be this little tiny thing that goes across, and
yes,
that's Venus.
Yes, the planet Venus, the nearest planet to us.
And nobody alive today will probably ever be able to see the planet Venus crossing the sun again for another 105 years.
Right.
That's extraordinary.
Yes.
So glad you're here.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Right now, untypically, you have an absolute chance, 100% of talking to Bob Berman. Okay, so now, you know, when Ray Graff is on, I always listen, and the phones are always ringing, and the thing. But when I'm on, you know, people say, it's just him.
It's funny. And sometimes it happens that in the beginning it's slow, and at the end people are always, they
mad.
Can't get
They're
in.
Angry.
So, yeah, this is the time now. Of course, you always know how to get people on. We could mention UFOs or Armageddon.
Okay, I will. Now, one night, Roselle and I are fast asleep in our beds. And all of a sudden, there is this blinding white light, which was reported by many people in the neighborhood. The police got calls. We had no idea what it was. I've always wanted to call you when you're on with Ray or somebody else because, you know, but then I would be monopolizing things, and I never like to do that. So the question is, what were we seeing?
That was a bolide, which is a name for a fireball, an exploding meteor.
Really?
And several times a year, they explode over all of our houses at night, but people are usually sleeping. They're unseen behind curtains, behind our closed eyes. But they happen fairly often, but you were lucky to have been awake and to have actually seen it. They're not that uncommon.
And how long does this last?
Oh, just a few seconds.
No. This lasted for more than a few seconds.
Well, then it was a routine UFO mothership.
That's what I thought, a routine, R-U-F-O-M-S, routine, you know.
UFO mothership.
UFO mothership, that's what it was.
How long did it last, that light?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to check in with Roselle, who's the last person on this issue. But it was certainly more than, you know, it could have been as much as a minute.
Oh, then definitely it was not a bolide, not an explosion. Well, then you have an honest UFO, unidentified.
Now, yes or no, you believe in UFOs?
Yeah, I believe there's life throughout the universe, but are they visiting us now? That would be so suspiciously sloppy and incompetent that they want to keep themselves hidden because they're not landing on the White House lawn. And yet they're spotted by this farmer in Kansas, and this guy here spots them. They're like cat burglars. I don't think creatures from another planet would be that incompetent that they just couldn't keep themselves hidden if that's what they wanted to do.
Well, we don't know what the level of that technology is, right? I mean, we know they may be able to make a rocket ship, but they may not know. They may not. Maybe they wanted just to warn everybody.
Maybe. There's some things we can infer. For example, all the flying saucers have ramps, whereas our private jets have stairs.
Yes.
So it means that they are handicapped sensitive. These are civilizations that have laws for...
And we know this how? We know this how, that they have ramps?
Because on every sci-fi movie...
Yeah, I was just going to say.
It's always ramps.
You're terrific. You really are. Let's go to Calvin. Okay, Calvin, you're in Woodstock. That's good. Go ahead, Calvin.
That is good. Hi.
Hi. We're ready for you.
Okay. Bob, you might know I'm an abstract painter, and I've been exploring.
He lives in Woodstock. Yeah.
Yeah.
As you
I've been exploring the similarities between aquatic and celestial worlds, and you once pointed out to me that I sometimes refer to the Hubble photographs, and you pointed out that this is a subject about color here because that came up earlier in your. That there aren't actually colors in space. You might not have said that, but that the Hubble photographs are assigning colors to certain elements, or what is it that you... Could you elaborate?
Sure. The Hubble telescope can't take color pictures.
Right.
So what they do is they take three separate images, usually to be scientifically useful. They'll take a picture in the light of glowing hydrogen, another in glowing oxygen, another in another material, another element, or they'll take three different filters, red, green, and blue, and then combine them to create a color photograph. But it's up to them what the final result will be. So many of the images that we see in magazines, many of those pretty things are faked because they can assign any color they want. And the most famous color astrophoto of all time, called the Pillars of Creation, just completely arbitrary colors that they allowed to bleed together, and it's gorgeous, but nobody would ever see that. In truth, in space, you can't see almost any color because our eyes are monochrome in dim light. You know, you turn the light off at night, and maybe you have a little night light, and the whole room is gray. You can't see color at low light levels, and most of the objects in the universe, all galaxies, most nebulae, are so faint that they would look gray even if an astronaut drove their off-road vehicle right up to them in some distant millennium in the future. If we could go right up to the Orion Nebula, it would still look gray. So inherently, our eyes would not see colors.
So it's sort of, Bob, it's sort of the same problem as we have on the old movie channel with colorized films. Somebody had to assign a value to each of the woman's hair or lips or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, interesting.
So is it that there is no color, or that our eyes are incapable of seeing them?
Well, that's a very interesting distinction. I'm actually going to talk about that tonight in Great Barrington, because...
At the Triplex Theater at what time? 7 o'clock?
At 7 o'clock.
Yeah. Okay.
In the old days, people used to think... This is so amazing, Calvin. In the old days, people used to think that whatever is out there in color is really there, and our eyes are just like clear windows to the real world. Mm-hmm. But the modern view is that there is no color out there, and that if Alan and I left the room right now, left the studio, and there was nobody looking, it's not that these things would have color that nobody would see. It's that it would be completely colorless and have no sense of brightness
at
all.
And why again?
Because light, it turns out, is just magnetism and electricity. And we can't see magnetism, and we can't see electricity. So everything that seems colorful out there in the external world is really just an invisible electromagnetic stimulation that's making our brains get a result, get an impulse. And then we assign the color. We see the color. It's not inherently out there. It does not exist in the real world. We are as necessary to see a red traffic light as the traffic light itself may be, absent any observer. There is no brightness. There is no color in the universe. It's a blank.
I've always wondered. Go ahead.
Is this similar to other ideas that we are actually in agreement about certain things? Like we're in agreement about what the value of money is, or we're in agreement about what a sound implies?
Well, we don't even know if we're in agreement about colors, because we have no way of knowing that what you and you see and I see are the same thing, what we call green. All we can say for sure is that it is not out there. The universe is actually a colorless, featureless blank until it's observed.
Hey, Calvin, great question. We've got to let you go. Thanks again.
Bye.
Your chances of getting in right now are 100%, 1-800-348-2551.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Fleet Feet Sports Colony, New York, locally owned retail shop providing footwear and apparel for runners, walkers, and triathletes in and around the capital region. FleetFeetAlbany.com. The Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to protect ecologically important lands and waters of the Adirondacks for nature and people. Nature.org/Adirondacks. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned business for over 50 years offering lawn and garden equipment, sales, parts, and service throughout western Massachusetts. BoydenAndPerrin.com. Electric City Chorus, a men's a cappella singing in the barbershop style with concerts and events throughout the year. Rehearsals Tuesday evenings in Schenectady. 518-391-9423. And Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, Massachusetts. Featuring a Boar's Head Deli with daily specials, bakery with home-baked pies, donuts, fudge, and fresh produce. Whitney'sFarm.com.
And we are back with the amazing Bob Berman. Let me just tell you that all five phones are ringing, so give it a rest until you have your turn. Now, we're waiting, Bob, for all of the early returns to come in from the other coast. All five phones are ringing, but it takes some time for the screener to write the stuff down, say, Rosie from Rosendale or something like that. Okay, so now we're going to go to Constance from Phoenicia. Okay, Constance.
Hi, how are you?
I'll bet you're going to ask about a comet.
Here's my question. Do all the moons of all the planets rotate in the same, go orbit in the same direction?
No. Most of them do, but not all of them, unlike the planets. Now, all the planets go around the sun in the same direction.
Correct.
It's a one-way street. If you were north of the solar system, looking down, all the planets go around counterclockwise.
Uh-huh.
And all the planets except for two spin the same way, and the sun spins the same way, and almost all the moons go around their planet in that same direction, counterclockwise. But there's one big exception, and that's Neptune's moon Triton. That goes around the wrong way. And we think that captured moons, moons that didn't start out where they are now, can go around in any direction.
Wow.
Whereas the moons that started, they had their birth with the planet, then they'll go around the normal way.
And how did they get born again?
We think it's all born from like little lumps in the pudding when the solar system was a spinning disk of dust and rocks that started clumping together.
If you were above the solar system and looking down, virtually all the moons would be going in the same direction?
That's right, going counterclockwise.
Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, again, it has to do with the birth of the solar system, and the sun rotates in that direction.
I see.
And the moon rotates in that direction. Interestingly enough, the sun and the moon spin at the same rate. That is, they make one spin in a month. That's kind of odd. But they all go the same way, yeah.
And you say it's odd, but we demand an explanation.
And the explanation just has to do with the way you... that gives us a clue about the solar system's birth.
Constance, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Yeah. And now to Rich in Wilton. Rich, you're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just kind of tuned in late on the way home from work. I'm in the house now. I heard you guys talk about speculating on UFOs. I think that's an important part of science, actually, thinking about life in the universe. But I was involved in a local event here that Ed Daigie even writes about in his book. I was an air traffic control specialist right here working in Albany in 1974. And I got involved in what they call the Round Lake incident. I call it that.
The what?
Round Lake incident.
Okay.
There were numerous troopers. First of all, I was working in the evening at the FAA Flight Service Station right here in the, at the Albany Airport, which is a separate building or function from the control tower, which has the approach control radar. I got a call from a trooper in Loudonville Barracks who wanted to know if we had anything on radar over the Round Lake area. I said we didn't have that kind of radar. We had weather radar. I said, why? And he says, well, we have numerous units, that is state police units, were up there at the Round Lake area. This was a summer evening, I recall, probably about 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And I said, well, what are you seeing there? And he says, well, we have an object over the lake that will break up into numerous objects, three or four separate ones, and then recombine into one object again. He wanted to know what they were. I says, well, I don't know. Let me check with radar. And sure enough, I called the supervisor over at the RAPCON radar approach control facility, and he said, yeah, as a matter of fact, we have been watching some objects over the lake here for some time now. I says, well, he says, why? And I told him, I said, troopers are on the phone right now. He says, I asked him, what are they doing? He says, well, they're breaking up into individual targets, three or four targets, and then they'll merge back again into a single target. Now, we're talking about primary radar hits on a target like that.
Okay, so Rich, just because there's so many other people waiting, what's the question?
Well, there's no question, but I just want to clarify. You were just talking about UFOs, but there definitely are these things. And here's an incident where an object or objects, whatever they were correlated on air traffic control radar simultaneously with ground observations by police officers.
Okay.
Bob, you have an answer?
Well, you know, we hear this kind of thing all the time. And in science, we have a saying that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. So the idea that there are, that we're being currently visited, I mean, not that there's life somewhere in the universe, we all believe that, but that we're currently being visited, but not usually. They're keeping themselves hidden pretty much, but here and there they're being spotted, requires ordinary proof. Extraordinary proof. Now, as we all know, in this age where everybody's got cell phone cameras,
right.
We do not see clear photos, unjiggly photos, in-focus photos of UFOs. And so this makes us suspicious. As a pilot myself, I've flown over this area. I have about 200 hours of night flight. I've never seen one. Now, Rich, you think I'm going to head towards a thing saying that you're wrong or this isn't true. I'm not going there. What I'm saying is that most of us, astronomers, would require More than that, only because we get calls. I've gotten calls here at the studio. I've spoken to the people afterward, and it turned out what they saw, even though they saw lights that were moving, it turned out to be, in one case, the star Betelgeuse, in another case, the star Sirius, in another case, it was Venus. In some cases, it cannot be explained at all. And your story can't be explained. I mean, I would guess that maybe the light was hitting a flock of geese that and the swarm came together and then spread apart, and it looked unusual, but I wasn't there. So,
sure.
I don't know.
But what I'm saying, though, is there were state police, numerous state police officers from this, and I talked to one of them who described the object.
You know, I believe you. I absolutely am not dismissing it. And I will tell you, there's a lot of, though, pranksters around in Stormville Airport. About 20 years ago, we had a group of pilots that loved flying at night in formation with their lights on just because they liked reading about the UFO reports the next day. And
I've got lots of gray hair, and I read all the books, too, and I'm a very scientific, technical-type person, but something like this is extremely rare and extremely, you know, verified by ATC radar as well. I'm a pilot, too, and, an astronomer for way back. I've done amateur work back in the 50s. But so what I guess I'm getting at is these things are real, and they are extraordinarily complicated in some cases like this.
Okay, I saw the light, and you saw this, it's... I'm for that. Thank you, Rich. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's go to James in Goshen. James, you're on. Hey, James, you got to turn off your radio. That's rule number one. James. Okay, James broke the rule. So off he goes. You can't, when you make this call, you got to put your ear to the telephone because there is a delay between what you are hearing on the radio and what we are saying in the studio. And that's in case some jackass calls up and is naughty. We have a dump button here that will take care of it. That's the scientific explanation, okay? Okay, let's go to Robert in Troy. All right, Robert, you're on. Hi, Robert.
I wanted to ask about the Albert Einstein's derivative formulas that were made by a guy named Lorentz. Mm-hmm. Lorentz.
That's right.
Like when you have a ruler, a ruler is 12 inches long and it flies at 90% of the speed of light, and its longitude, its length shrinks to like an inch or something. And what I was wondering about were two things, like how did Einstein and Lorentz get away with squaring the value of c, the speed of light, when Einstein goes painfully and says like 10 times in a row, you can't exceed the speed of light, period, that there's an asymptote on the graph. So if you're like, in other words, like say you have a rocket ship and a UFO moving on a head-on collision course, it's not the addition of velocities, like with two cars crashing at 60 miles an hour, it's 120 miles an hour, but you can't actually break the speed of light even with the addition of velocities.
Okay, I'll explain that. Now, Heydrich Lorentz, when he formulated this, we still call it the Lorentz transformation. I see what you're saying because there is a square in the formula. The formula is the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared shows you how length will contract or mass will increase or time will slow down. And there is a c squared in the formula, and c is the speed of light. So that might lead you to believe that we're talking about something faster than light. But it's not, because in this formula, if you insert your speed where it says v, let's say, and then actually work out how that works, the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, even though c squared is in the formula, you will always get a figure that's less than the speed of light. It's just part of the formula, but you will never wind up faster than the speed of light.
I understand that. I scored 100% on my last math exam, and I also use a Cessna.
So what I say, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. I've worked the formulas out. I did it in my spare time. I can't offhand remember the formula myself. I guess
it's simple. It's the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared, where v is your velocity.
Robert, you're done. Thank you very much. Appreciate
it.
Okay, let's go to Daniel in Cropseyville. Daniel?
Hello. This is Daniel in Cropseyville. I'm calling mainly because I want to know, Mr. Berman, what you think about string theory in general.
Okay.
That's the main focus of it. But I also am specifically interested in the idea that, you know, string theory is relevant outside, you know, up until the fact that you can't test it because there's too many, the energies are so high, you know, the energies required to actually perform experiments.
Okay, here's everything you need to know in string theory for our listeners in 1 minute, the 1 minute Reader's Digest
version.
Oh, I'm
going to like this. Thank you.
The idea is a noble one. It's almost a Buddhist thing. We're trying to find unity, e pluribus unum. We're trying to find unity in the universe, just like we found that magnetism and electricity go together, and mass and energy are two sides of the same coin. Well, of the four fundamental forces, there's only four forces in the universe. We want to see that they're really one at heart. And so grand unified theories, such as the type Einstein struggled unsuccessfully all his life to create, is the holy grail, and string theory is the latest. Here's why no physicist I know likes string theory. The idea that on the tiny, tiny levels, a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of the size of an atom, the nature of reality are one-dimensional little wiggling lines, and depending upon how they connect, circles, or do they stay whole, or do they connect at the end, can create all the forces. Wonderful idea, but it doesn't work. So in order to make it work, the string theorists had to invent another dimension. Okay, we have to have a fifth dimension. Now that's not enough. A sixth dimension, add a seventh, an eighth, a ninth, a tenth. And if we add these mathematically, we can make the thing work. Now there's no evidence that there are additional dimensions. And here's the problem. There's no way to test that there are additional dimensions, and there's no way to test string theory.
Right.
So most physicists say this. Look, if you're not doing experiments and not doing observing, you're just left with things in your mind. If it's not testable, what we call falsifiable, then really, what's its value?
Well, here's that gets to the crux of my question, which is that when I talk to people who believe that string theory is something, or whether they believe it or not, it's something that they pursue, what I find out is that they feel driven to it by the mathematics. Is it some, you know, I mean, is, do you, you know, what I hear consistently is that, you know, the math drives us to this.
Yes, I understand. But you have to also understand that there are things in math that have no analog in real life, and that very often these people who are brilliant, these are brilliant people, are in a world of symbols. Now, just as the square root of minus one has no reality in the real world, but is vital for some mathematics that are being done. The problem that many physicists have with string theory is that it can seem to work mathematically, but then again, you know, you can prove, I don't know if you know this proof, but you can prove that 1 and 1 is 3.
Without I do know that proof.
Right. Without making any mistakes in your math. So
yeah.
Our main problem is that with these 11 dimensions, and there's no evidence at all that they exist, well, just let's leave it at that. Let's just say it's speculative.
Daniel,
Daniel,
I'm so sorry. There are five people behind you. We want to make sure everybody gets a chance.
I appreciate your time.
Daniel,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the great call. Appreciate it. Yeah. Okay. And let's go to Jim. Okay. Jim, you're on.
Hey, if you could just explain the Big Bang Theory, I'd appreciate it.
I'd like to hear that, too.
Simply put, if you trace the paths of all the clusters of galaxies in the universe, everything is moving away from a single spot. And if you extrapolate in reverse, everything was in one place 13.7 billion years ago.
Wow.
So that suggests that there was, we won't really call it an explosion, but there was an origin for everything that began mass, energy, and everything else we know. And if that happened, other things should have happened also. For example, there should be a certain ratio of hydrogen to helium, about 4 to 1, with a little lithium left over. There should be a all-pervasive heat coming from everywhere. And we have that. We have that 2.73 degree Kelvin warmth coming from every part of the sky. So because of this, it really seems that the Big Bang was for sure. However, we don't know what could have caused it. We don't know what preceded it. And so it's still rather mysterious. And if the universe is infinite, as the evidence has been pointing for the last 10 years, the Big Bang may have just been a local event. It may have been something that began our neighborhood of the universe, but not the whole universe.
Interesting.
No, Bob. Well,
thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's hard to believe that it just never ends. It's just infinity. It just keeps going on, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's not hard to picture. It's impossible to picture.
Yeah, correct.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, that is so interesting. Now, I know I'm a dummy, but we have a universe. Is our universe in other universes, or is the universe it?
Well, first you have to see how you're defining it, because if you define the universe as everything there is, then
you stop right there, then there's only one universe. Right.
If you define the universe as everything we can possibly ever observe, well, then we know already that there are things that are forever beyond our universe, and so we call those other universes. We know that at most we can observe about 1% of the galaxies in the universe, and the rest lie over the horizon in a realm where their light will never reach us. So our sampling size is at best 1%, and more evidence since 1998 is pointing for the universe to be infinite, and that everything we can ever see is actually 0%. Of the whole thing.
I love it. Okay, let's go to Lou in Lowell. Hey, Lou, are you really listening in Lowell?
Yes, I am.
That's out there in the universe, you know.
Well, Ludlow.
Ludlow, yeah, okay, go ahead.
Anyway, earlier you were talking about the night sky turning bright, and I had a similar experience, but I actually got to see what did it.
Uh-oh.
And it was a meteor. We were in Vermont camping, and it was late in the evening, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I was watching the embers burn down in the fireplace, and suddenly the campsite lit up like daylight, and
exactly.
I just happened to be sitting in the right direction, and I looked up, and I could see it going across the horizon.
Dr. Shartok said that it lasted a full minute.
At least.
Well, that may be relative, yeah. This lasted.
No. My relative was lying right next to me, and she saw it also.
Did you time it on a clock? You know, in other words, the time that you think it lasted may not have been that long. It may have been 15. I mean, because this thing took quite a while to traverse the horizon.
How long?
I'm guessing a good 15, 20 seconds at least.
Yeah, that's
not
long.
More.
Yeah.
Yeah, that if it was 20 seconds, I agree with you, then it could have really been a brilliant meteor.
Well, I actually saw it. I mean, it was quite amazing. There was like a corona of flame around it, and it lit up the rock, and you've seen the pictures of space rocks, you know, that are taken out in space, and it looked just like that. It was aerodynamically unstable. It was rocking up and down. There was a stream of smoke coming off the back of it.
Hey, Lou.
And it lit the campsite like daylight.
Oh, that's great.
Hey, Lou, that's a great story, and thank you so much for telling about that experience. We got to take some little time for some underwriting, okay?
All right.
Bye.
Bye. Support for the Roundtable comes from Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Identity Eyewear, it's what sets you apart. EYEDENTITY eyewear.net. Buckley Beef, Valley Falls, New York, providing all natural grass-fed beef, steaks, hamburgers, and sausage, available at McCarroll's Village Butcher in Delmar. BuckleyBeef.com. Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York, a classroom in the wild helping schools, organizations, and individuals reconnect with nature, history, and the arts. AshokanCenter.org. Shedman Custom Woodworks, building sheds, gazebos, animal shelters, and outdoor furniture for over 25 years. New Lebanon and Brunswick, New York, Shedman.com for inventory. And Woodstock School of Art, Woodstock, New York, offering studio classes in fine art, no experience necessary, new for summer portfolio development for high school students. WoodstockSchoolOfArt.org for schedule and information.
And we are back with the amazing Dr. Bob Berman. He's a wonderful man. He knows so much about everything. Let's go to, by the way, your chances of getting in are pretty good right now. We've got two people, James and Megan, and after that, we're all yours. Let's go to James in Goshen. All right, James, you're on.
Hello?
Hey, you're on.
Okay. For the last 10, 15,000 years, humans have been extracting resources from the ground and transforming into cars, automobiles, television sets, houses, bridges, which this amounts to trillions of tons of weight. Would that affect the balance of the axis of the Earth at all in any way?
No, because we're taking it from the Earth and it's still staying on the Earth. It's not being removed from the Earth, so it doesn't affect our spin. Actually, the only thing that affects our spin is that sometimes when there's a major tsunami and the weight of Earth, and we're talking about millions of tons of seawater, the spin actually does change by a tiny fraction of a second because of that. Briefly.
Yeah, but the weight stays on the Earth, but in a different location.
Yeah, but, you know, the cars and all that, they're just not that much. There's no real change. Even a tsunami only changes things. We're talking about by a millionth of a second of rotation. And it certainly doesn't shift our axis because the Earth's mass, think of it, 8,000 miles of stuff going down. That what we do on the surface here is just a drop in the bucket, really.
Thank you, James. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
All right, let's go to Megan. From Beckett, where everybody's dancing all the time. Megan?
only on the south side of Beckett. My question, I just recently saw the movie Melancholia about a planet that was hidden behind the sun and eventually it ran into Earth and Earth got destroyed. But what's the possibility of a planet actually being hidden behind the sun, rotating at the precise right speed so that we couldn't actually see it? And I'm going to hang up and...
No.
No hanging up.
Rule number three. Go ahead.
Yeah, there was actually a sci-fi movie with a similar theme going back to either the 60s or the 70s, something like Journey to the... I forgot what the name is now. In any case, it's not possible. Some of these are very imaginative, that the Earth is an analog of ours with our own selves on the other planet, except they're somehow in reverse. Like, you know how, like, all of us always, when we take our socks off at night, we always fold them up neatly?
Right.
Well, in that other world, they throw them on the floor. They do things that we would never think of doing. The reason it can't be is because Earth's orbit is not a circle, but an ellipse, which means we speed up and slow down. And anything that was in our orbit on the opposite side of our orbit would peak around one side of the sun or another at various times, because when we're moving fastest, it would be moving slowest and we'd see it. Plus, an object the size of Earth would influence comets, just as Mercury and Venus and the other planets do. And we'd see their orbits change when they came near to this object that we couldn't see. And there is no anomalous behavior of inner solar system objects. So there's nothing there on the far side of the sun.
So that's that, right, Megan?
Yeah, that's okay. Fascinating, though. That's
all right.
Something they didn't think of. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Somebody will probably tell us about this or ask you about it tonight. Where are you going to be at the Triplex Theater in Great Barrington?
In Great Barrington at the Triplex, not just talking about, but we're going to have demos and beautiful images of light and color in the universe.
Well, I love that place.
7 o'clock.
They deserve good luck.
I've never been there.
Oh, it's wonderful. You called it the Triplex. I always call it the Triplex. And sometimes I call it, depending on the movie, the Triple X. Okay, let's go to Bob in Hudson. Bob, you're on.
Great show today. I wanted to point something out. There is extensive footage and many, many photographs of UFOs that are quite clear. And they go on for quite a length. And in particular, there was the incident of the Phoenix Lights, where a 2-mile-wide flying wing flew right over the city of Phoenix. It was seen by thousands of people, and it was extensively filmed and photographed.
All right, let me ask you something. Let me play devil's advocate here. Astronomers are generally well-educated. They come in every type of religious persuasion, including atheist, agnostic, and everything else. We would love it if the universe was populated by other life forms that were visiting us. That would make increase our budgets. We'd like that. Why do you think that astronomers are such skeptics when it comes to this stuff?
Well, first of all, I never said that they were from another planet. The existence of man-made anti-gravity craft goes back to the middle of the last century. And our own Air Force has anti-gravity craft they admit it. I've seen them. It's something that you can see on television, in documentaries. So I'm not saying that it's coming from another planet, but there certainly are flying craft in the sky that are anti-gravity that have been photographed and seen and filmed.
Okay, okay, that's the second time going around. So
again and again. That's why I don't understand your skepticism.
Well, he explained his skepticism, and you explained that you think it's in you know, that it's happened. And we thank you for your call. Thank you very much.
Okay, and let's go to John in Newburgh.
You're much kinder than some of the other people here.
Really?
Yeah, you really are.
You mean there's no sense in alienating anybody if you can avoid it. So I try not to, but on occasion, I alienate people. And for that, I apologize profusely. So let's go to John in Newburgh. John.
Hi, good afternoon. I just read something that talked about the unification of physics. And what it did was it basically talked about faint diagrams and the difficulty mathematically of those diagrams versus a new approach called the unitarity approach, which made the calculations a lot easier. Can you elucidate on that, please?
The unitarity?
Unitarity, where the sum of the probability, 20%, was the gist of that method. The calculation is easier.
You know, you're going in and out. I can't even.
Yeah, no, the phone is not working well, John, in Newburgh. I don't know why. You're dropping out.
Okay, that's better?
A little bit. So you're talking about the unitarity approach?
The unitarian?
Unitarity approach.
I've never heard that.
Me
you explain
neither.
It?
Okay. It's a new method of calculation having to do with, I guess, Feynman used diagrams to talk about particle possibilities and what have you, quarks and gluons and so forth, colliding and so forth. Are you familiar with these concepts?
Yes, I am, but of course I'm not a particle physicist, so it's a little outside my realm, but do you have a question about this?
Is there a question?
I just wondered how the unitarity method made calculations easier, and basically the unification theory itself. What does that mean?
Since I don't know about this unitarity thing, I can't answer that.
John?
Do you have a backup or alternate question?
Or we could just tell John he stumped the band. He stumped the band, John.
Well, quickly, I was going to say, I also read an article talked about how this, how we burn off helium as hydrogen over the many trillions of years to come will actually affect stars trillions of years from now and how they actually may ultimately not exist.
That one I think we can answer.
The only thing is the connection just faltered on a couple of keywords there. When you said we, do you mean how the sun is burning up its helium?
All stars in general will eventually burn all the hydrogen out. Is that correct?
Well, not all, but much of it, yes. Yes.
And so eventually is that the end of the universe as we know it?
No, not really, because there's lots and lots of free hydrogen and always will be in nebulae in places that are too diffuse to ever condense into stars. So there'll always be free hydrogen. Also, some of the helium itself in the stars in turn combines into further nuclear processes to create things like carbon and oxygen. So that, for example, when the sun, which is a common type of star, collapses in its old age, it actually won't have very much hydrogen or helium. It's going to be composed of oxygen and carbon. And that's what white dwarfs are composed of.
Hey, John, we got to say goodbye, giving everybody a chance, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Let's go to Mary in Newburgh, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, Mary, you're on.
Okay, I want to know if there's a theory that, I don't know if this exists or not, about how everything is created in one instant and is experienced in one instant, like simultaneousness, like the Big Bang, and that the only reason we see it is in time and in space and causality is because there's no other way to understand it, and that perhaps there is such a theory. I'd like to know more about it, if there is such a theory, and what the name of it is so I can find out about it. And if we have to know theorem and calculus, advanced calculus, in order to understand astronomy as we know it today, as the astrophysicists.
I can make that simpler. When Einstein, in his two relativity theories, when he talked about space-time, he talked about events that occur in this matrix that permeates all space. And if you see it in space-time, then things are not separate in time and in space. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have a batter stepping up to the plate, and he hits a pop-up. that stays in the air a long time and is caught by the, let's say, second baseman. Yeah. The next batter hits a line drive. It goes quickly to that same second baseman. Now, plotted in an Einsteinian way, plotted through space-time, both those events were identical. They took the same paths through space-time. They had to, because they didn't have rocket engines. Each baseball was left to travel freely on its own. They both started and finished at the same place. Now, we in the bleachers saw one ball go up a lot higher. That is, it looked like a different path through space, and it took longer, so it looked like a different path through time. But in Einstein's way of seeing things, both those events, the line drive and the pop-up, were identical events through space-time. And I think this is what you're talking about, that if you could see things that way, you would see the universe very differently. But it is a mathematical way of looking at things. Space by itself doesn't really exist, and time by itself doesn't really exist, except as a tool of animal perception. We animals use it to make sense of things. So it's a little specious to say, well, if we could see things through space-time, because it's really mathematical rather than experiential.
Well, Mary, thank you for calling. I appreciate it very much. Let's go to the professor in Central Massachusetts. Go ahead, Professor. We only have seconds, so go ahead.
Okay. We've had photographic records of the ice caps on Mars, and since ours just melted, I wonder if there's a comparison that we could make between Earth and Mars. I mean, are Mars ice caps also melting away?
No, they're not melting, and they're very different. The northern cap is mostly water, like ours. The southern cap is mostly carbon dioxide. It's dry ice. So the temperatures are very different. Mars essentially has no air pressure. It's only 1% of ours. So a completely different ballpark for the two. Also, Earth can have liquid water, and Mars cannot have liquid water, because even if you have the right temperature, you need pressure for liquid water to exist. So in the case of Mars, the ice just sublimates. It goes directly from a solid into a gas. So it's a very different story, even though both of our worlds have ice caps.
Okay, Professor, thank you for that. Let us go to Daniel in Granville, New York. Daniel, you're on, but only for a minute. Go ahead.
All right, well, real quick, I just wanted to ask about Tesla's theory of wireless electricity. That basically was supplanted by Edison's theory, and whether or not that's still a possibility, or why it hasn't been explored more, of using the Earth's atmosphere to conduct electricity wirelessly throughout the world, I guess.
The reason is that it just wouldn't be practical, because you need such high voltage to make electricity want to go through the air. Remember, electricity is the movement of electrons. And if you have super high voltage, you know from exhibits that you've seen that you can have sparks and lightning. In fact, lightning is an example of that through the air. But air offers resistance. And so electricity does not want to go through the air readily. Whereas if you have a nice copper wire, you can have electricity run for hundreds of miles, especially if it's AC. So Tesla did create AC, great, and he gave that to the world. But the idea that you could, in any practical way, make it go through the air would be not practical and be frightfully expensive. It's infinitely cheaper, easier, and further to make electricity go through metals.
Thank you, Daniel. Okay, and we're going to take a real chance here because we're almost out of time. Sharon in Amsterdam. Sharon, you got to ask that question real fast.
Okay, real fast. I understand that Venus is not going to be visible in the evening sky after this passing of the sun. If that's true, for how long will we not be able to see it?
Oh, yes, we're going to lose it, and it's a shame because it's been so beautiful. After this transit on June 5th, and again, reminder, buy Welder's Goggles shade number 12 or come to Mohawk Mountain House or definitely see this. But after the transit, it's going to go into the morning sky, and Venus will be the most beautiful morning star, especially throughout the month of July. But then it'll get lower as the summer wears on into fall. It'll be visible right through until December, but lower and fainter. And unfortunately, next year, 2013, will be a very bad year for Venus in either evening or morning. So the glories of Venus that we've been seeing and enjoying are almost over. In the evening star, as an evening star, and then we're going to see it as a morning star, and then That's really it.
Okay, and Sharon, thank you. Was that Sharon? Yes, Sharon, thank you very much. Charles, we can't take it today. Call next time a little earlier, and you'll be happier. We're just about out of time. I want to thank everybody who called in today. I'd also like to thank our friend and the wonderful astronomer Bob Berman for stopping by. The support for the Vox Pop comes from Joyelle's Jewelers, Del Mar, New York, specializing in custom jewelry and repair, laser welding, designer jewelry and gifts, joyellesjewelers.com, and the Schenectady Museum and Planetarium, science discovery, demos about optical illusions on weekends at noon during the month of May. Planetarium shows weekends at 1, 2, and 3 p.m., schenectadymuseum.org, and words. Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington, for peony, clematis, lilac, iris, coleus, viburnum, so sorry, and dwarf conifers, plus tools and vegetable starts and information, wardsnursery.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the wonderful Zach Beloy. Answering the phones today was Christy Carton. Boy, is she a terrific volunteer. Our producer is Patrick Donges. I'm Alan Chartok. Moyers & Company tomorrow. Next week on Medical Monday, Dr. Carl Atkins of St. Peter's Hospital joins us to talk about medical oncology. Stay tuned now for a news update. Thank you, Bob.